ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, we have a great guest. I'm speaking with Xavier Kochar, the CEO of the Video Genome Project. It's the largest, broadest, and most granular structured database of video content in the industry. Its mission is rooted in the belief that the world's data should be accessible for all to use, and its innovative data structuring technology has had massive implications for video content curation tools such as search, recommendation, and personalization. Additionally, the company's Insights division provides analytical lens tools, which it layers on top of its structured databases so that its advertisers, agencies, and content providers can glean actionable insights relating to video content that are used to drive business decisions. Prior to his work on the Video Genome Project, Xavier was managing partner of MediaLink, where he helped to build the firm from its infancy into the media and advertising industry's preeminent strategy and implementation company, which was later acquired. The Video Genome Project was also acquired recently by Hulu. And Xavier and I spoke a few weeks before Hulu's big announcement of their live TV service, which is now available in beta. In addition to Hulu Originals and a selection of thousands of TV shows and movies, live TV is now available on Hulu. This is big news, and if you've been following this show, you probably know I'm always interested in talking about live television. Xavier, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about everything that you do or everything that you've just put together. Really glad to have you here. For listeners who aren't familiar with the Video Genome Project, could you describe what it is?
Yes, absolutely. And again, thank you, Gabriella, for having me on this podcast. So the Video Genome Project is a structured data company whereby we created a technology that goes out into what we call the collective. And that really is any open digital ecosystem, such as the World Wide Web, and sources disparate semantic data sets, that is words, irrespective of what platform they may be on, what publisher, even what format or organizational schema they might be, and finds them, gathers them, cleans them, organizes them, and puts them into a central repository, i.e. a structured database, so that they can actually be examined and analyzed in an apples-to-apples fashion. Once they are, we actually can glean intelligence and concepts and thoughts and ideas. It's really an amazing thing. We have this belief that there was all this intelligence in the world, and that if we could just clean it and organize it, then we could give this intelligence right back to the world in a usable format. And that's really our company's mission, which is to make the world's data usable for the world.
One of the things that I've been to a bunch of conferences, and what we have is we have this increase in content proliferation, and we have unprecedented fragmentation of platforms. And so consumers have less ability. We have this explosion of content, but less ability to have the content the consumers want to have them get to it. So this sort of comes at that problem, right? I mean, it's sort of the field of dreams problem. If you build it, will they come? And they won't, because they don't know it exists. But your project helps the consumer. So nuts and bolts, are you searching the web for written data about content, or are you looking at the content itself, or is it both?
It is both, but it more heavily leans on the former. The technologies that actually look at the bits and the bytes that do frame scanning because of false positives or things that a machine may find important, but humans may find extremely irrelevant. And let's say you and I are having this conversation across this table, and there's this Coca-Cola can. Well, the Coca-Cola can may appear as something that is, that it may appear as, hey, you know what, there's a Coca-Cola can in this shot. But the Coca-Cola can could be completely irrelevant to any of what we're talking about, or about this scene. But what we thought was, you know who is best equipped to tell you what is relevant in any video? is the actual users themselves. Since the beginning of language, since the beginning of communication, you know, we share ideas and concepts of what we feel is important. We share that with one another, and we actually do so in quite a good fashion. And especially when we're one-on-one or in small groups, what'd you do this weekend? What'd you think of this? Or I took my family to go watch this show and I thought it was great. It's that we share those ideas quite well.
Right.
And we have for a long time. But the difference in the last, let's say 10 years is that we continue to share them, but now we share them in a fashion that is recorded because of we have the platforms, broadband penetration, device penetration. Really, the exchange of ideas are now being recorded in semantic form, in word form. But the problem is they're not being recorded across the world in one centralized database. And because they're not, it's very hard for a machine to do anything with it because they're all so disparate. We thought, let's try to put as many of these concepts and ideas in a centralized database. And there's one of two ways to do it. One, you can either ask the world to come to a centralized database and sort of type things in as you have structured them. And that's kind of what like an IMDb might do. That's called crowdsourcing, of course. And we thought that that might be a little more prohibitive to get people to come to a place and force them to do it in a format that you deem is the right format. So instead, what we did was we said, hey, world, you stay out there. You continue to share concepts and ideas and words in whatever fashion you want. We'll develop the smart tools and technology to go out and find it and organize it ourselves so you don't have to do anything. And then once we do, we'll give it right back to you so you can actually tap into the intelligence of the rest of the world.
So you're data scraping from different places and putting it and analyzing it. Where are you data scraping?
We don't like to say we are scraping.
Okay.
Scraping implies there's sort of a negative connotation with the word scraping. And I say that we don't use that
I'm not trying to put a pejorative in it. I'm just saying the data resides in different platforms, different places, different social mediums, and you're accessing it. Is that fair?
Well, the signals reside. So oftentimes, most times, if you take a look at what finally appears in the Video Genome Project, you would not be able to recognize it based on the raw input data.
You are collecting this raw, like you're people farming the data from these other databases. You're not having them come to you. You're not crowdsourcing it direct.
Correct.
So you're collecting it. You're putting it into your hopper. You're scrubbing it, cleaning it, making it not tie back to a particular individual, but perhaps you are tying it back to certain data about who's saying what. I mean, some of these, depending on where you're getting, that's why I'm asking sort of where, what are your data sources? Is it like Twitter and Facebook? Are they, or is it just,
right,
you know, where are they?
Right. Good question. So one thing that's has been very important to me from the beginning, since I founded the company, being in the IP space and also being in the data space, where what we do is we had sold and licensed out our data packages, is I'm extremely cognizant of taking other people's work, other people's data. That's a big no-no. That's why I'm against
scraping. Yes,
that's why I instead what we collect is absolutely unequivocally publicly available information. And we draw connections with publicly available information. So for instance, nobody owns the data point that Beauty and the Beast came out, was released in 1992. That's publicly available.
Twitter allows you to access, as does Facebook, all sorts of data. I mean, it's publicly available.
Through their APIs. I mean, there's two ways to do it, right? You can, as you say, scrape, or you can access it through API keys. And really the bigger platforms like Facebook, they're very keen and they're very cognizant on the ability of others to collect data without APIs. So they're very clever in that they're constantly changing up their pages. So it becomes a little more difficult to automatically collect. You know, the point that I was making about other people's data. When you are licensing data packages, particularly data packages that include publicly available data, one thing that's very important to remember is that what you are paying for when you have a subscription to any metadata company, unless it's a wholly owned, unique, altogether new data field, typically what you're paying for is the service that that company or that technology, the service they provided to package that data up in a central place.
Right.
So you break out in most of the metadata fields. They are not, no one owns the fact, like I said, what
you're right. It's not unique and proprietary. It's publicly available. But I guess, can you give me one example? Because I'm having just for those listeners who aren't data scientists, you know, give me one example of where you source this material.
Yes. So I can give you, given the fact that it's no longer my call, and to be honest, we didn't publicly reveal our specific data sources because that's part of the
magic. That's part of the secret sauce, yes.
Well, that's right. So, I mean, we don't, we're very, very efficient in where we go, but I can tell you categories of places. Like, so there are fan sites and blogs and, and social media and really anywhere where there is an exchange of words in any format about video.
Okay.
So, and actually people think, especially when we hear the term conversation about video, people think that that must be social media. I will tell you, social media tends to be a lot of noise. The noise to signal ratio is so high that it almost becomes not worthwhile. That's one of the things we figured out pretty early on, and I think that's one of the reasons why our company had as quick a growth cycle as we did, is because we didn't just put our lips to the Twitter fire hose and say, well, even though we know there's a lot of intelligence there, it just wasn't efficient. It wasn't efficient to structure that. So we found these gems all over the World Wide Web that allowed us to get there fast.
So that actually feeds perfectly into my next question, and that is, you do this globally, cross-platform. I mean, sort of how wide do you cast your net? What about cultural nuances?
Oh, what a great question. So we started in what we knew best, which was English language. And let's call it American nuances. We had to start with some library. And we tracked the highest usage as the place that we started. So if you think of video as the video curve, there's the top part of the curve and then the middle part and then the long tail.
Mm-hmm.
What we said is, likely the videos that users care about the most are at the top. And so let's start gathering raw metadata about those videos first and then work our way down the tail. And you know, there's something very, very interesting that happened when we used that approach, is that we discovered that there's a natural balancing. The more people care to know about a video, likely the more metadata there is about that video.
Hmm.
So what I mean is that, you know, a movie like Star Wars or a TV show like Breaking Bad, the volume of raw metadata is going to be so high relative to, let's say, a 1940s foreign film from France. And what we thought was, well, that kind of sucks, right? Because you want the metadata to be relatively you want it to be deep, no doubt, but you want it to be relatively even. And we struggled with this in the beginning until we realized that usually the people ask, users ask the toughest questions about the things that they want to know about the most. Bringing this back to your question about where do we start. The video set that we used was primarily professionally produced long form video when we started 4 years ago.
Okay.
So film and TV. And then once we had established this library of hundreds of thousands of videos, then what we did is we started working with, we were a B2B company. And as we started working with MVPDs and other video distributors.
You do their libraries, yeah?
Correct, right. Correct. And it actually, it was interesting because most of the time, you know, because our database was so comprehensive that we had their library already.
Right.
And anytime there was new content, we would use our engine to go, you know, if they said, hey, we just did this deal for this new content with this studio. If we didn't have it, we would spin up our technology and go and gather the metadata for that new content.
Can I just jump in for one quick question? Because that does raise a question for me is, does the system learn and do you update previous, do you periodically renew with current thinking about older properties? You know, because as culture shifts, we had this conversation actually over coffee about what is truth is malleable over time. So do you go and revisit, you know, Star Wars, sure, you know, super fantastic, lots of stuff. But if people are rethinking how they feel about the sort of prequel episodes in light of the new episodes, because maybe they can free themselves up for hating the prequel episodes or what have you, is there updating that goes on?
Yes, absolutely. That's something that I love seeing the most because we get to see how the world, when I said that we gather the world's data and we give it right back to the world, we get to, and we tap into the world's intelligence, we get to see how the world's intelligence evolves, or in some cases devolves. It's a great point. You're bringing up a great point. And I will tell you one of the core products that we had, a big root for this as to why we wanted to create the VGP in the first place is because we were extremely family oriented. What we thought is that as new media platforms and new devices are coming into our homes, what we thought is that families and in particular parents are not always.
Oh yeah, no. That's actually really, it's very true, and it's interesting that that was one of the driving force, you know, things for you. Because as a parent, when my children were younger, it was really challenging. And I'd say, you know, what's interesting is as a consumer, they couldn't really access your Video Genome Project data, though, could they? I mean, it was business to business. They had to use somebody who used it. Correct.
That is true. And this by no means, this wasn't a censoring tool at all, but it was an appropriateness tool. So maybe one family, certain types of things are appropriate for one family and another family. And one of my inspirations for this was that one of the heads of the divisions of the Walt Disney Company, early in our development, I was sitting down with him for lunch and he told me a story of something that happened to him just the weekend before, where he brought his six-year-old into a Disney movie. It was a Pixar movie. And in the middle of the movie, he had to take his six-year-old out of the movie. And it was, I want to say it was a rated G movie or something, because it was too much for the six-year-old.
Right.
And that sort of hit me. And I said, wait a second. This is the president of a division of the Walt Disney Company. And so that really hit us that not all families view content the same way, and not everything is appropriate for families.
Well, sure. And so rather than having sort of the ratings, which are sort of ham-handed ways of going through it, it'd be great to be more granular so that if some people really are tweaked by violence versus sex, you know, there are different things that are of more importance to one family's values than another. And so that certainly, I still think that's a need and a niche. And I would argue that parents have lost control over a lot of it. And the sort of fire hose that people talk about, big data fire hose, there's a sort of a content fire hose and parents just get beaten down, you know?
Absolutely.
And so, Absolutely. So it's great to think that there is this data that will be usable. Hulu's just acquired your technology. Yeah. That's, you know, going to give them, I would think, a huge edge. Certainly, we've done a lot of research around millennial content consumption, and I've come to believe that the over-the-top platform with the biggest user base serving the right content to the right audience will win, because piracy is largely driven by access and finding things. So if you have your user interface, user experience, and you also get what you want when you want, that's really the magic. So I think you've just given them the magic key to the kingdom.
Well, we'd like to think that, and really a lot of credit to the senior management at Hulu, CEO Mike and the CFO Elaine, as well as the head of product over there, a guy named Ben Smith. And really the thesis was around personalization, exactly what you said. Hulu is very, very keen, and I believe was very well positioned even before our acquisition, before the acquisition of the VGP. And now this is just going to send them into overdrive on this notion of personalization. The idea that we have the ability, we have the content, we have the platform, and now we have the technology to deliver any individual user or any group of individual user or profiles the right content at the right time, at the right lengths, in the right way. And that this idea, you know, and I was telling the story about this exec at Disney with the six-year-old boy, I didn't realize it back then, but that became the inspiration for personalization. We never thought of ourselves as a personalization company 4 years ago, but the idea is once you have such granular information on any video, and you take this granular information and you marry it with any sort of behavioral or usage-based data, now you can deliver to a user that same type of hyper-personalized experience if the user wants it.
Right.
If the user doesn't, and the user says, look, I don't want, like, this whole thing is maybe a little too creepy. I just want the general market stuff. You know, don't learn about me. Well, that's fine too.
Right.
But now we have that option. And really, to that, to your point about updating the database. So we have a gene. We call them the highest level of structured metadata. We call them genes. And we have a gene called adult themes. And that's part of a larger gene set, five genes that spell out the word values. And those are V for violence, A for adult themes, L for language, U for unsettling elements, and S for sex. And they spell out values. And this was one of our first products, values, because remember we our origins were around family and making content appropriate for any one household. And what's interesting to see, just in the last 4 years, I'll give you an example of a gene, adult themes. So metadata that was around, let's say, homosexual relations. 4 years ago, that would light up in our system as something that was an unsettling element.
Okay.
Today, it doesn't. Today, it is much more accepted. And by the way, this is not us determining it.
No, it's the overall public, the general. So you're not, it's societal norms are influencing it. It's not an algorithm. You're not determining what the values should be. The society is telling you what the values are.
That's exactly right, which is both, I would say, a strength and a potential limitation, because our database is only as good as the
society that creates
as society.
It. Well, I think that the society will be happy then, you know. I mean, I think you're good. One of the things we're running tight on time, but I wanted to touch on really quickly is you are a serial entrepreneur. I know you don't like that. So I would say instead you're a serial problem solver. And concurrent with being a serial problem solver, you also host a very interesting dinner where you marry tech people, money people, and media people in a sort of a small intimate setting where they can freely exchange ideas. Now, is this where you figure out what your next big move is going to be? You hear these conversations and you think, aha, this is the problem I'm going to solve?
Partially, yeah. I feel extremely lucky in that I have had an opportunity to learn from some amazing executives. I've had phenomenal mentors. And, you know, oftentimes the best ideas don't necessarily come out in a vacuum or in a lab. They come when sitting down and sharing concepts and perspectives from a diverse group of sets of people. And really over the course of my career, the other companies that I've built have all in some way, shape, or form, looking back on it, so, you know, to Steve Jobs connecting the dots in rear view as opposed to when you're going on it, when you're going through it, they have all sort of taken this theme. And to your point, yes, I do host a quarterly dinner where we bring together C-level media and technology and advertising executives with Wall Street and institutional investors. So basically the money that is funding media and tech and the operators that are running those industries. And so we see a lot of gaps. And it's a time of sort of immense tumult, which is on the one hand bad. On the other hand, you know, there's a lot of opportunity here to not just disrupt, but just take advantage and try to fill some consumer needs, some business-to-business needs, some technological needs. And so I don't want to create a company just to create a company. I don't want to raise money just to raise money. It's really, it's got to be something that, there's got to be a problem that's a big enough problem that affects people, a vast majority of people. And it's something that can utilize some element of technology to efficiently solve that problem. And the third part is probably most important, is that I can actually contribute some level of subject matter expertise or relationships, i.e. value to it.
Sure, you can find a way to make it, you know, 6 degrees of separation for everything. So you can make it work. What excites you most about what's happening today?
Well, I am super thrilled that machine learning and sort of machine learning's, older brother, which is, or older sister, which is artificial intelligence. I'm fascinated by where we're headed with this. I'm fascinated about where this goes. I'm fascinated about the ethical implications of this. I'm fascinated about, you know, where we stop it. I'm fascinated, around, you know, at what point do we lose control? All the economic implications, which jobs go first? How are we going to, you know, so it's really the pace of growth and innovation. I would say as long as you continue to be curious, as long as, and I think that's something that's driven me throughout my, not just career, but my life. I'm fascinated by how things work, why things work, why things are, and more importantly, why things are not.
Right.
And now you kind of don't have to wait that long, for society to materially change and witness sort of the cliche examples of things like ride sharing. I mean, could you ever have thought 5 years ago that you could order up movement, i.e. transportation, the same way you could order a pizza? And what else is out there? Like I said, I'm just to kind of finish this thought. The idea of, around artificial intelligence, and if you combine that with haptics, if you take the ability of a machine to process information at massive scale and marry that with our own brains in some way, shape, or form, because the human brain, we have an input-output issue. Actually, we don't really have an input issue. We have an output issue. That is, we can't share processed information fast enough out. If machines can help process, not just process intelligence, but actually then disseminate that intelligence to others quickly, man, it's going to be something. I mean, and we'll have a lot of the ethical challenges around AI are not going to be, you know, 20 years from now. They'll be a couple of years from now. So that's what I'm most fascinated by.
Cool. Wow. Thank you so much for taking a lot of your time. I really appreciate it. We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who have helped bring the program to life. First, my friend Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open, and of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. A big thank you to our guest, Xavier Kochar. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week right here on Up Next.